Do you ever want to watch a bad movie?
Do you ever hate yourself so much that you want to put on a movie that makes you want to rip out your own eyeballs?
Worst movies ever.
Probably.
Welcome to the worst movies ever.
Probably.
My name's Dottie James and I am so scared of horror films.
And my name is Patty Walters and I don't fear anything.
So we compromised and we decided to watch terrible horror films together this Halloween.
But before we get into that, there are three things that I say at the beginning of every podcast, and I have said them since the beginning of time itself. But before I even get to those, I feel like there's a potential important trigger warning to talk about in this film, which is potential animal cruelty, questionable practices towards bugs, specifically caterpillars and moths. I don't know. It didn't make me feel great, so I just didn't want to risk it. But the three things that I say at the beginning of every single episode in this podcast are, firstly, stay inside this Halloween. There's a fucking pandemic. Wear your masks. Keep everybody safe. Secondly, vote on the 3rd of November. If you can, vote for whoever you want, but I think Trump's an asshole, so I advise against it. And thirdly, we are going to spoil every single wonderful moment of this film, so if you do not want Deathbed, the bed that eats, spoiled for you, do not go any further. However, this is a really, really good podcast. I'm proud of this one. This one turned out sick.
Today, we are watching Deathbed, The Bed That Eats.
Yeah, and we were excited about this one purely because of the title, and I think it lived up to every single expectation that we had.
In some ways, and then failed us in many others.
But you know who never fails us? You know who never fails us in any ways is our good friend Harry Allen, who's joining us on this episode.
It's so much fun to talk about these films with friends who also are equally baffled by them.
Yeah, and Harry is not only just one of like the brightest lights in our life, he's such a great person, but he knows more about cinema than almost anybody that I know personally. He's like a pop culture aficionado, and just breaking down every nuance of this film and every flaw of this film with somebody as well versed in this topic as Harry was just, it was so much fun. It was so interesting. And I don't remember the last time I laughed quite this hard during and before COVID-19. I think this is the hardest I've laughed all year.
With that said, let's jump into the episode.
Harry.
Hey.
Welcome to the podcast.
Oh,
this is really fun.
Gosh, thank you so much for
having
me.
How are you feeling?
Yeah, I'm good. Well, real time, we've just finished watching the film, so I'm actually looking for you to answer a lot of questions.
I've got
so many questions.
Well, I did too, and it's why I've seen this film 5 or 6 times to try to answer my own questions, and I will do my best to answer your questions too. I can't make promises, but I will try.
Are you scared to go to bed now?
Well, the thing is, I love sleeping. Like, I was late today because I had a nap and I thought this film is going to genuinely haunt me.
Well, that's a perfect place to start, isn't it? So this is the Deathbed, The Bed That Eats, released in 1977, made on a budget of $30,000. It was written, produced, and directed by George Barry, the only film George Barry ever made.
What does George Barry do now?
All I know is that, you know, this film just sort of happened. It never got a release until George Barry found some sort of internet forum talking about this movie and people had just found it somehow.
Oh.
And then it was released to DVD for the first time in 2003, I think.
I want to get into the head of the guy who wanted to be a filmmaker but felt, I've got all of my ideas out in that film. He's made his Titanic and now it's like, do you know what? I can bow out on a high.
Yes.
The film is starring a couple of people. I'm just going to go into it like this. The credits are in a really, really strange order. So, I mean, who would you attribute to being the protagonist? Who do you think the main character of this film is? Who do you think, or if not that question, who do you think is going to be mentioned first in the credits? Because I have that answer for you.
I have two guesses.
Bring it on.
Painting Man or Shannon?
I think her name's Sharon.
Oh, Sharon.
It is Sharon. Her name is Sharon.
I instinctively would also go for Painting Man, or if they're going to credit the voice artist for the bed, which I know was just mainly like yawns and, and so, some sort
and
of
crunching.
Some crunching sounds. But yeah, I would go for painting guy or bed voice artist.
Okay, so nobody's guessed correctly.
Okay. What?
I wouldn't have guessed correctly either. All I'm saying is Diane is first in the credits.
Diane?
She's the one rocking the double denim.
What?
Oh, Diane.
Yeah.
Did we even get Diane's name during the film?
I think Diane says her own name, and that's the only time it's mentioned. And I think the only other time it might be mentioned is obviously like Diane and Susan have a contentious relationship. Like Diane hates Susan, and Susan is like, Diane's a bitch, and she just made fun of me the whole car ride. Apart from that, we don't get Diane's name ever again.
Okay.
So Diane is first in the credits.
I feel like there was a point where I felt like they were really setting up Diane as the,
yeah,
like our final girl, lead.
But she was only lunch.
Well, she has more charisma than our actual final girl.
Yeah. I mean, if there was an Oscar winning scene, we all know which one. It was.
Oh, Diane. Do you think that was her audition scene?
Yeah. Sorry, could you just drag yourself along the floor for
20 minutes?
Yeah. Second, any guesses?
Oh, did I not get it right? It's not painting, man.
No. Okay,
Shannon.
If Diane's one, I Sharon. Go for Sharon as two. Yeah, I think you're right. I think Sharon's number two of Diane's.
Sharon's brother.
No.
Second in the crowd. Skelly hands. Second in the credits.
Does Sharon's brother have a name? Or is he just Sharon's brother?
Sharon's brother is Sharon's brother in the credits. Okay.
Right.
He does not
but
get a name.
But the second starring role in this film
is Sharon's brother. Sharon herself is sixth, but Sharon's brother is second.
Oh my God. Okay.
So there was some weird sort of politics going on as to who's getting the highest credit here.
Diane won it.
All I will say is Sharon's brother is credited as Rusty Russ. But when you look him up on Wikipedia, it's William Russ, and he's actually done a couple things. He was in American History X and Boy Meets World, the TV show.
Oh, okay.
I can find who he played in them respectively.
Does he have hands in them?
No. That really happened.
Did he make a sacrifice?
That really happened.
Have those special effects. That was, yeah.
So yeah, either he got tired of Rusty Russ as a name, or he tried to distance himself from films such as this.
I think it might have been a thing where, like, you try out a cool nickname when you're younger, but then you completely sever from your life after that.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, sure.
That sort of thing.
Third in the credits, do you want to guess, or shall I just take you through this now?
Shannon.
I'm going for Sharon's sixth.
I love that you're all just...
I'm going for In the Grave Girl, the former love of the bed.
Yes. / demon person.
You know, yeah, I'm going for her.
She is fourth.
Okay.
Credited as The Resurrected.
Is it Susan? Is Susan?
Susan is
one?
Third.
Fuck Susan's
sake.
Third, yeah.
So it goes who? It goes Diane.
Diane.
Rusty Russ. Yeah. Susan.
The Resurrected. Fifth is The Voice of the Artist.
So that's not the same guy.
No, and then sixth is Sharon. And then seventh is The Artist.
Oh my God.
Okay. So he had like a body actor and a voice actor.
Oh, did the voice actor do anything else? Because it was so like the Fat Controller from like Thomas. It was so...
I don't think so. I'll look it up for you.
The Fat Controller laughed.
Yeah.
I'll look up what he's been up to. He's credited as something else. I just noticed it upon this rewatch.
Did he do the bed as well?
No, he did like some sound mixing for this. I think he's credited as sound mixer.
He didn't do a good job.
Oh God, no. No. This has some real sound issues for sure. Well, Patrick Spence Thomas is the name of the voice actor.
Okay.
Who has done films as recently as 1992, but only in the sound department. Every other thing that I'm looking at is sound department. Yeah, so voice of the artist, fifth. Artist himself, seventh.
After Sharon.
Oh my God.
Way below her own brother.
What's Sharon doing now?
Oh, fucking nothing. I bet you that. I bet you she's not doing anything. I'll look it up.
She's still sat in that shed.
Yeah, of course. Nothing happened to her.
We didn't even get a put a death scene before Sharon.
Rosa Luxemburg, who plays Sharon, is known for this film and only this film on IMDb.
Anything else? Is she like a car salesman now?
Has someone on YouTube not done a Where Are They Now?
Yeah.
Have they not done like a TMZ?
Again,
like,
I know it's
a reunion.
One of those like Zoom reunions they're doing for like Mean Girls and Lord of the Rings and things. Can you imagine?
I'll take you through the rest of the acting credits. So, Side Order played by Marshall Tate. Does anyone know
is
what that
the
means?
Chicken?
The bucket of chicken.
The chicken bucket.
The chicken.
Played by Michael Tate.
So I reckon Victim Inside Order. It might be that couple at the beginning.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah. Sure. And then both the gangsters are credited, and beyond that, nobody's credited. So there's a whole bunch of people. I don't think the voice of the bed is credited.
There was that whole brothel narrative.
Yeah.
So let's dive in. I tried approaching it chronologically. I just don't think you can.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I'll dive into it, but please, if you have like questions or comments, just jump in.
Okay.
Because there's a lot to unpack. There's just so much. You can go pretty deep with this movie.
Is it based on a book?
No, it's based on a dream that George Berry had.
That according makes sense.
I love that.
Yeah, he had some sort of surreal lucid dream and was like, this is the film.
That makes so much sense. And it was the 70s.
Yeah.
So it wasn't a dream.
So this movie is kind of telling two stories at least. There's like the elaborate backstory of the bed itself. And then there's the story of like slaying and vanquishing this bed once and for all. Mm. And they sort of come head to head at different points in the film, but it's tough. So let me take you back. The year is 1897.
Okay.
There's a demon who lives in a tree. You still with me?
Yeah.
Yes.
The demon in the tree sees a beautiful human woman and he changes himself into a breeze blowing through her hair, her mind, and her dreams. The demon conjures up a bed to make love to the maiden, and he takes the form of a human man except for his crimson eyes. And he says something along the lines of like, because all demons have blood in their eyes or some shit.
Yeah, I did enjoy the red eyes. I thought that was quite, it was a shot they used quite a few times.
Yep.
You know, they knew it was the moneymaker, but yeah, I wasn't mad at the red eyes.
So the demon and this woman, they christen the beautiful bed. Did I say he conjures up a bed?
Yeah,
you did. I did say that. Okay, sorry. I am already lost. They conjure up a bed, but tragically, the woman dies because fucking a demon is some serious shit, according to this movie.
Yeah.
The demon is heartbroken, cries tears of blood onto the bed, and flees to a barren tree where he lives still to this very day. But his tears gave the bed life, and with this life, a hunger. Also, the woman's family, the Blake family, soon find her body on the bed. Is that what happens?
No.
Or is she already in the ground?
I don't know.
Her daughter's buried. I think they bury their daughter.
But she's alive.
Well, yeah, because the idea is she's under the ground.
Yeah.
In comparison to how just like gratuitously they just show you boob, they're very light in the demon screwed her to death. Like they say it very poetically. But yeah, assuming she died on the bed, I guess the bed would eat her or...
You would have thought, but I don't think it was a deathbed yet. It wasn't a bed that eats at this point in time.
It wasn't a deathbed colon, the bed that eats. It was merely a bed.
Either way, this family bring this bed inside, right? They bring the mysterious bed into their home, except we learn a little later that the woman is only half dead, buried in the ground, right?
Yeah. It's very fanficky.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, like he had blood eyes. He cried tears of blood on the bed.
So with all that said and established, thus begins a pretty epic 80-year feast for this hungry-ass bed. Mm. It eats the rest of this woman's bloodline, countless couples, an elderly gay woman, a little girl and her teddy bear, two mobsters and a priest, and a self-decreed doctor claiming the bed cures impotence. And at one point, it even devours an entire religious orgy, which, for a bed that eats, it doesn't get a whole lot better than that. Let's be real, that's a really good day to be a bed that eats.
Here's the thing about it devouring her whole family. They presumably had their own beds. Why were they sleeping?
Yeah, I mean, I think of the list of victims are like the victim montage. My favorite is the mobsters having like a on the bed sort of like slumber party card game. Like, why on earth was this happening?
But like, they're like 50-year-old men sat with their legs crossed facing each other.
Because also they really, really went in on like the brothel.
And yes.
It was like a sort of religion. I don't know what it was.
And they plug the bed into the wall and there's circus music. It's just a fucking weird
time.
They
take it outside. They try and like say it's like some sort of rejuvenation, like ascension cult bed or something.
Wait, we didn't talk about the artist's death.
So I'm about to talk about the artist.
Okay.
I'm not going to refer to him as the artist. I'm going to refer to him as Painting Pete.
Okay.
Painting pee. Okay, I like that.
Feel free to participate.
That's great.
Pee-pee.
It's up to y'all.
Pee-pee.
So now it's present day, which is also 1977.
Yes.
Meet Painting Pete. Pete's dead, but only kinda dead. Not half dead like the woman who fucked a demon and is now kinda dead. He's like died 60 years ago and is now trapped in purgatory behind a painting that he painted on the wall kinda dead.
That kind of death.
So Painting Pete was in fact a painter before he died. He painted the very picture that now holds him hostage. The painting is of the bed that he died in, sick, which is possibly the reason the bed didn't eat him and instead chose to keep him...
As like a pet.
Yeah, as like a pet. He just keeps him around, albeit in his own like lonely limbo. But yeah, he's like a Tamagotchi, just chilling.
Yeah.
Feed him a ring every now and again.
Yeah, Painting Pete, I found a questionable character in that. Well, his big thing was like he would sit behind the painting and watch these people get eaten, collecting their treasured items. He's got like a handful of like rings and things.
And a leg brace.
And a leg brace. And he's like, so sad that the bed has eaten all these people, but I love all my jewelry. Yeah. He's like, oh, I just wish I could warn them. He doesn't make a huge effort to. No. Like, he doesn't make a huge effort to try. It's like, maybe try, Pete. Try just knocking on the wall, be like, the bed eats Pete. You know, there's no, at no point is there any effort on Painting Pete's side to be like, oh, you know, I'll see. Yeah. I'll see what I can do here. Yeah. Also, what's the threshold for what makes it over to Painting Pete and what just gets lost in? Because I didn't see Painting Pete with a chicken bucket.
No.
he got the leg brace, but he didn't get the chicken bucket.
Well, you have to remember the bed returned the chicken bucket.
That's true.
He also didn't get any of their clothes.
Yeah, well, the bed does make a real point to like undress its victims.
It really does.
Only the women, though.
Yeah, what the bed does with the clothes, I can't tell you that. But we're just going to believe Painting Pete at face value. And what he says is that he can only be heard once every 10 years, which is the only time the demon that unknowingly gave life to the bed, goes to sleep.
Oh my God.
The movie's narrative is mostly told through Painting Pete's internal monologue, but it's not especially clear if he's speaking to us or himself or the bed. Like, there's moments where he's like scolding the bed, like he's its disappointed dad.
Yeah, he's like, you naughty thing.
Oh no, look at what you've done again.
Yeah. But then there's other moments where he's like more introspective and his dialogue's like a diary or something. And there's other times when he's like concerned about all these visitors and they're about to be victims and he's like speaking to them. It's wildly inconsistent. I can't follow it. I don't have an answer.
Yeah, I mean, he does feel like a bit of a sociopath watching these people die, but then at the same time, they are no more emotional about their dying than he is. You know, he is very like, oh, you're dying, how inconvenient. But it doesn't ever feel as though the victims are that upset or that, you know.
They have the same attitude of, oh, I'm dying, how inconvenient.
There's not a huge amount of fight. Yeah.
So with that out of the way, we'll go through scene by scene. So the film begins with the sound, you've probably forgot about this, but it begins with the sound of someone, or more likely something, eating for 55 seconds, just eating.
Loved that opening.
It's great.
I was like, sold.
It's bold.
I loved it. I thought it was brilliant.
It immediately communicates what's going to happen.
So just biting, chewing, crunching, no visual information whatsoever, just eating sounds until the title of the film's first act is revealed, Breakfast.
Loved it.
It's original. So breakfast. We now see the exterior of a large stately home. In a far corner of the estate, we're taken within a sort of gray brick structure. The cellar, it transpires. So it appears that almost nothing fills the large space within. A fire burning beneath the mantelpiece, a rug hanging up on the wall, a big, beautiful canopy bed, with matching burgundy sheets and curtains. And lastly, a large painting. A painting of the very bed that it shares its walls with. We hear snoring coming from somewhere in the room. And as we move nearer and nearer towards the painting, we hear a voice. It's Painting Pete. He sits, slouching, despondent. We learn that he died 60 years ago, but that's about all that we know at this point. We cut briefly to a large metal gate outside. A couple, their arms around each other, let themselves inside. The gate swings open again as wide as it can, and clang!
closes on nothing because there's nothing to meet the gate.
It's the most poorly made gate I've ever seen.
Whoever built the gate didn't build another side for it to latch onto.
The gate goes clang. Let's somehow just not question it, okay? Now we see the bed. Oh my God, it's waking up, we hear Painting Pete say. The bed yawns, and it is the least evil, like most lackadaisical yawn ever.
It's like, ah.
Yeah, it's like Bill and Ben. It's like, yes, full-blown. It's full-blown kids TV voiceover.
Which makes sense because these are the TV shows that were on at the time.
Yeah, totally. It sounds like it's voiced by like Ringo Starr.
It really does.
Well, the voice of the bed isn't credited, and for all we know, it could be.
There we go.
So the bed yawns. It's waking up. The couple walk up to a large front door of the stately home. We cut back on the bed. It's laughing. The bed is laughing now. Mm. And it's not like a sinister cackle. It's like, this is going to be good. They put all this weird psychedelic delay on it. It sounds like something out of Monty Python. Mm. It's weird.
Or Scooby-Doo, as I noticed when we were watching it.
Totally. It's not scary. It's not effective.
Yeah, this film is a lot of things, but scary is not one of them. It's not one of them.
So now we see the inside of a door. It's the front door of the house, and it's bolting itself shut on its own. The couple try the door, and yes, it is in fact locked. They walk to a different nearby door. It, too, is now bolting itself shut.
Even this is weird, because there's two door handles right next to each other on the door. There's nothing normal.
So many minor details. It's like, but that's not even right.
You've seen a door before, surely.
Come on, George.
Yeah.
So the couple try a second door. Nope, nothing. They see another door. It locks itself too. They can't open that one and because it's locked.
Each of them trying the door handle and the locking is the same shot. That's been repeated three times, I think.
It is the same shot.
Yeah.
But then, just when you expect to watch another identical shot of a door locking itself, one door swings wide open. The door to the cellar. They spot the door and they walk inside and they find the room and they find the bed.
Mm.
So the couple walk up to the bed, and the man removes a box of matches and one small white candle from his jacket pocket.
Mr. Lotharia.
Yeah.
It's like a stumpy, unscented candle.
It's really bad.
In an already lit room. I don't know what this dude is thinking. The man also rustles through a brown paper bag, and he pulls out two small apples, a bottle of red wine, and a huge chicken bucket.
It's
for breakfast.
For breakfast. He thinks he's being super romantic with his apples, his wine, and his chicken bucket. And his candle.
So he presents all this food on the bed, and with that out of the way, they make out until the woman asks her tonsil hockey partner if he's locked the door. So he walks over to the door. Strange. He must have indeed locked the door after they walked in. Anyway, more making out. So we see an apple on the bed, close up, tightly in focus, while the couple fool around in the blurry background. We begin to wonder, maybe this is just an artsy framing technique, but then we see bubbles.
Foam party.
Bubbles.
We see yellow bubbles and they're fizzing up from within the bed.
Yeah.
Then the apple begins to lower on its own somehow, slowly sinking into the mattress to reveal like a deep bath of corrosive and like violent yellow liquid.
Yes.
Yeah, I'll be honest, because like now I've seen the whole film and how much they relied on this, you know. It's slightly tainted it for me, but when this first came on the screen, I was so into it.
Yeah, right.
Yes. I thought it looked brilliant.
Yeah.
In fairness of like the journey of the film, at this point in the film, I'm on board.
Yeah.
I'm like,
oh, yeah.
It's
a nice subtle like apple death.
Yeah.
And it leaves you thinking like, oh, I wonder how else the bed is going to kill people.
Yeah, no, this isn't like a Final Destination or a Saw film. Like, it's not coming up with new and creative kills.
No.
Like, it's got one move. It's like Homie with the chicken bucket.
I mean,
and
in
the
its
candle.
Defense.
This film has one move.
In its defense, it is a bed.
Yeah.
Perhaps our expectations were a bit too high.
I was like, you know, when I thought deathbed, I didn't think they were going to go for like stomach acid. I was thinking like either the mattress separates from like the bed frame to create like a sort of flappy mouth type thing.
Yeah.
Or like the bed sort of folds in half. Then it's like kind of anthropomorphic in that way. I thought the stomach acid thing, I was like, this is cool. Like,
it's that a corrosive bed.
This was unexpected.
So yeah, there's like a large vat of pee now devouring this apple. Visibly dissolving the fruit and audibly munching and crunching away. So the apple rises back up to the surface of the mattress, but only the apple core remains.
It does make me wonder if it would leave the crusts on a sandwich or something. It's like
grow up.
You're
bed,
a bed.
On.
You can eat the whole thing. Yeah.
Then we see more of the same frothing yellow foam, and it wants the bottle of wine and the chicken bucket at the same time now. So they both sink. Well, the bottle of wine sinks.
The wine.
The bucket kind of just tips over a little bit and pours chicken wings into the acid bath. The liquid magically uncorks the bottle and glugs the red wine.
There's like a pop sound as well. Yeah. It's amazing.
What I appreciate about this bed is that in fairness to it, it went for the food first.
Yes.
Like you got to think if this guy was a bit more prepared and didn't just bring like a chicken bucket and some apples, actually could these people have been spared? If he brought like a real picnic.
True.
That the bed could have just gone for. It's like, you know what? I'm full. I'm not going to pick out. I'm full. It's only breakfast.
Exactly. You don't want to feel heavy throughout the whole day, do you, Bed?
Yeah, so you've got to appreciate there that, you know, chaotic evil he is not.
Yeah.
Like, you know, he did, in fairness, go for the edibles first.
Absolutely.
So hungry Bed, it drinks the wine and it eats every last bite of the chicken meat, leaving only bone. The bed generously returns the empty bottle and the cardboard bucket of bones, though.
They pop up as if they're coming up from like a lift.
So the couple press pause on getting it on when the woman mentions that she's feeling nervous and hungry. The guy discovers that everything's been inexplicably eaten, which is strange. The woman then says, "Don't worry, I wasn't hungry anyway." So she's inexplicably not hungry anymore. He doesn't care that the bucket's full of bones and the bottle's empty. Like, we're all the way over
it. Yeah, personally, I would have stayed with that longer.
Yeah, he's so willing to accept, oh, actually, I might have packed an empty glass bottle and a bucket of bones. That is something I think I did.
Yum. Sounds like me. What am I like?
So they get back to it. Things are heating up. It's fast. Shirts are coming off. Breasts are being handled. Curtains are closing by themselves. It is just all happening. We pull back, we see the bed, curtains drawn, and we hear the couple screaming. Bad screaming. The kind of screaming that suggests they're both being eaten by a bed.
Yes.
We see a limp arm droop from the bed, blood streaming from its fingers, dripping down onto the floor as well as onto the teeny tiny candle.
they take a few goes to get the drop to land on the flame as well.
The hand is twitching with every toothy bite from the bed. Blood pools into the candle and the flame, like you said, eventually dies. We see Painting Pete. He's face palming with both hands. The curtains on the bed open without assistance and it's empty and neatly made. And the opening credits roll.
I'm going to say at this point, I mean, if this was a short film, I'm sold.
Yeah,
like great.
That could be deathbed, the bed that eats, roll credits. I'm in. I loved it.
Mm-hmm.
So the bed is now asleep again, snoring and giggling. Meanwhile, Painting Pete is talking to us or himself or the bed or like, who is this man talking to? He's talking to somebody. So we start getting a much needed history lesson about this bed. There's stock footage of a Victorian city, whirly twirly newspapers from years past with headlines that read, "Thousands disappear. Strange munching sounds heard in the night. Mayor demands action and mayor disappears."
This bed used to be a serial killer.
So let's talk about strange munching sounds heard in night.
Makes the headline.
It's the headline.
Slow news day. Big time slow news
That's
day.
That's the sound that you hear from the bedroom when I've gotten up to eat in the middle of the night.
Yeah,
exactly.
So Painting Pete is now giving like a stern, disappointed lecture to the bed because he's very upset with how irresponsibly the bed has been using its like telekinetic powers that it has, I guess, taking out all its frustrations on the stately home.
Yeah, is he the bed's father?
No,
child.
Either way, it's the bed is like cracking the pavement, and it's cracking the windows, and it's making statues cry tears of blood, and then it's cracking those too.
And the whole time, Painting Pete is just going.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But eventually he mocks and taunts the bed so much that the bed ends up destroying the entire estate, everything except the cellar.
Oh, I missed
that. When did that happen?
Yeah, I didn't catch it on the first or second watch.
That's why later on Diane says that, oh, that I'm sure we'll find the estate soon.
Like, that's why they can't find it.
Is the idea that what, the literal house come like crashing down?
Painting Pete is like agitating and taunting and mocking this bed so much that it explodes this estate. And you don't see it. You just get this weird rumbling sound effect, and then it cuts to black, and then you see a very small sort of stone landscape, and it's supposed to be like, oh, he blew up the house.
Right.
It's really confusing.
Yeah. That's not clear at
all. Yeah, I'm not expecting like a Michael Bay 2012, like full-blown day after tomorrow. But that wasn't obvious.
They could have at least said it. That's like, he could have said, oh, well, now look what you've done.
Well, that's the thing with this film, that nothing in this film is acted or said through dialogue. It's all said through internal. You could have at least had Painting Pete be like, oh, I can't believe he's blown up the estate.
Yes.
Like, do us a favor. Like, everything else is so literal.
And this is the other thing too, is this is why it doesn't come across clearly, is the entire estate explodes. You barely notice it. And then the thing they cut to next is we see the bed, and then we hear a fly, and then it eats the fly with a slurping noise.
That was kind of great. I loved that.
But that explains why. See, I mean, like the previous couple, they're trying the doors right. They found the place. These women cannot find this house because it doesn't exist anymore.
Yeah. Oh, that makes sense.
Right. Why are people going to this house?
I don't know.
I'm hoping you'll be able to tell us.
I can tell you a couple things. So the couple that die in the breakfast act.
Yeah.
They go to the house purely because this guy knows that nobody comes here. So he's going purely.
You said the breakfast act, and I thought you meant like sex. I was like,
hey,
is that
another
word?
Some breakfast?
Yeah. The
breakfast. No, you mean the first act. It's called breakfast. Because it's like caught in the act, right?
Yeah,
that's the
making
saying.
Making breakfast.
And then I just saw it was a twist on that.
No, Act one, titled breakfast.
Right. Continue.
He takes this woman here because he knows that it's like unattended, like a ghost town or
totally.
Whatever. The only reason they explain why Diane and her friends from work come here is because they're looking forward to like a quiet weekend outside of the city. And her lawyer friend is liquidating the assets of this place. So she's doing like this job on the house and knows that nobody's going to be there. So she throws Diane a solid and is like, you know what? Like, just go and have a good weekend. I won't tell anybody. So basically, the entire estate has been exploded. Meanwhile, a sweet 70s car drives up into the estate, drives through the gates and onto the property, and act two begins. Lunch.
Yeah.
So the car parks and out step Diane, Sharon, and Susan, who are looking forward to a quiet weekend getaway from the trappings of whatever city they're from. These three don't actually say a lot to each other.
They think a lot about each other, though.
We have a few brief insights into their internal monologues, but basically they're here because Diane had the hookup. She's already fed up with Susan's bullshit, and Susan doesn't feel particularly well. Also, Sharon took off without telling her family. That's all we know.
Oh, we didn't know that. Oh, yeah, right. Yeah,
okay, that's sort of...
It's later than this, and it's one very lost line of dialogue.
Susan makes me hate her in the first paragraph of whatever she says, where she's like, oh, I don't feel very well. I shouldn't have come. I shouldn't force myself on people. The only thing Diana said to me was to make fun of me. And it's like, well, fucking yeah. Why would you force yourself on a holiday with someone that clearly doesn't like you?
Yeah.
Susan is a very unlikable character.
I hate her. I hate Susan.
And they really like amp her up as like the
main girl.
The main girl. Like, and we're really intrigued by like, oh, what's going on here for Susan? Why is she so upset?
Yeah.
And Diane's like, I love Diane. Diane's like this like cool action hero lady.
Heck yeah.
She looks fierce. Like, we love Diane. Sharon's a ghost.
Oh my God, we hate Sharon.
Sharon, like,
she's a husk of a human being.
She is.
So the three of these women climb out of the car and they comment on a foul stench in the air. They look for the large stately home, nowhere to be seen because it's exploded. Possibly recently, possibly fucking years ago.
Yeah, we don't know how much time has passed between breakfast and lunch.
We have no idea.
But also at some point, Susan has wandered off from Diane and Sharon.
Yeah. Yeah.
Who have had quite a long tour of this estate and walked around for quite a while.
Like ages.
And then at some point, Diane, I think, or it can't be Sharon, she doesn't have a single bit of dialogue. Diane's like, where's Susan? I'm like, she's been gone all this time.
All day, Diane. Yeah.
And then Sharon teleports. Yeah. Sharon's a ghost, of course. Because
yes!
Sharon is a ghost, teleports.
She does teleport.
To Susan. We're really, really supposed to be like caring about what's going on with Susan.
Yeah.
What is the twist with Susan? What does Susan know? Who is Susan?
I think the person that wrote this script must have never seen a film before, because they're like, we need to know every character's internal monologue throughout everything, just as in life. Like, we do know what everyone else is thinking at all times.
Right.
Can you imagine if in like this man had directed The Shining or something, and instead of "Here's Johnny," we got "I'm killing you because I'm mad."
I have gone mad. I am more of a loose cannon than I was when the film began, as you'll notice.
I am scary.
So these three guys, they ditch their car and they go explore, first finding the graveyard where the entire Blake bloodline has been buried. We see the half-dead demon fucker. She appears dead in her coffin, but her heart is beating still.
Yes, but we don't know this yet, right?
No.
Yeah, we don't know who she is.
At this point in the film, we thought this was Susan.
Yes.
Yeah, well, of course.
Because the actresses look so similar. And again, we are so led to believe.
And my favorite part of this is she looks so similar to Susan, you think it's her. But the whole thing is that Sharon and this woman are supposed to look uncanny to each other.
Yeah. And it's like, won't kill Sharon because Sharon's like got the same eyes as
the dead girl.
Yeah, Sharon is so clearly the first kill.
Yeah, you
like,
would think.
We know quite a bit about Diane. We know quite a bit about Susan. Sharon is like the third empty body character. We don't know anything
husk
about
her. Husk of a girl.
Yeah.
So they walk through the graveyard and then they carry on and eventually find the cellar, home to the hungry bed and Painting Pete. They pace the peculiar room. Diane declares that the bed will be big enough for all three of them to share later tonight. But Sharon's a fucking weirdo and she's like walking on top of the bed of this, like, she's
on
top of this immaculately made bed with her shoes on. It's like, bitch, you've just established that like other people have to sleep here. You were just in a goddamn graveyard. Grow the fuck up, Sharon. What are you doing?
Consider it.
Sharon's a ghost.
Sharon's a ghost.
And while Sharon's standing on the bed with her nasty ass graveyard shoes on, the bed begins to bleed on the inside and Painting Pete can sense this somehow. And he doesn't know why, but it definitely has got something to do with this bitch in particular. Anyway, Susan is still feeling really unwell, so she decides to take a nap in the bed, and Diane and Sharon peace out to continue to search for this house that doesn't exist anymore.
Susan cements herself in being even more unlikable to us and Diane by saying like, oh yeah, I'm not going to sleep in the bed. I'm just going to sleep there now. And then she's like, what about tonight? She's like, I don't sleep at nighttime.
And then she's like, if I pretend to be unwell, they have to drive me home. It's like, girl, why did you come in the first place? What is going on for Susan? She's trying to sick trip herself out of a vacation that no one asked her to be on.
Yes. It's so
Susan
selfish.
Is a sociopath.
Hate her.
So Susan begins undressing. And as her clothes come off, the bed begins breathing heavily and frantically.
Oh, it's
it
awful.
Is panting. And it's either masturbating or super excited to finally have somebody new to eat. It's not made clear. Susan looks at her reflection in a compact mirror and it shatters. And I don't know why this happens.
That bit was kind of fierce.
You liked that, didn't you?
Well, what bugs me isn't even that the shot's in here. It's like, why is somebody supposed to be looking at the reflection before they go to sleep?
You know.
Who does this?
for the bed.
She climbs under the covers
for the bed.
And begins to go to sleep. So
wait, one second. We get our second boobs while she's getting ready for bed.
That's
completely
true.
Unnecessarily.
Yeah. So far we're 2 for 2 of every female using this film has to show breasts.
Technically 4 for 4.
Actually, no. The first girl who dies only gets one boob out.
Yeah,
so
one
we're
3 for 4.
Yeah, the guy, if I remember right, the guy does some real weird...
Heavy-handed.
He's real heavy-handed with that boob.
So remember how Sharon's family doesn't know where she is? Her mom sends her older brother off to find her again.
Their voices over the shot of Susan.
Yeah.
Which is very confusing.
Their first lines of dialogue are over, like, Diane and Sharon's backs walking away from the camera. And it's like, we don't know who these people are. You can't do this. So her older brother has to find her again. Apparently she does this fairly frequently. And that's the most we ever get about...
Because she's a ghost.
About Sharon's character development.
Yeah. Fair play to Sharon's brother, who probably has more actual spoken in-the-scene dialogue than every other character combined.
Meanwhile, Susan is in a deep sleep and dripping with sweat. The hungry bed is manifesting nightmares in her subconscious somehow. Again, more powers this bed has that we never really touch on.
Yeah.
We are transported into her dream, where she's being forced to eat live bugs.
It's very like a 70s art show, her dream.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's just like a white block.
In a brutalist room.
In a brutalist room. And this woman is just feeding her moths and caterpillars, which make crunching noises.
Apparently.
Yeah, it's very Timon and Pumbaa. It's a very strange nightmare.
And then the yellow bubbles are back and they gobble up her necklace. The bed uses more of its like telekinetic powers or whatever to really slowly and arduously decapitate Susan by like flossing her throat with her own necklace chain. Her head is never really cut off. She just bleeds a tiny bit from her neck and also from her toes for some reason.
And then she gets like absorbed anyway.
So the little yellow bubbles fully submerge her and she drowns in pee acid. And the hungry bed has a very smug chuckle to itself while chomping away at Susan until she becomes nothing more than a skeleton in a wig.
It's so fierce that the hair survives.
The bed can eat through skin and muscle and organs, but not hair.
Suitcases. I mean, I hate finding hair in food.
Yeah.
So the bed's just like, oh, hair, no.
I'll eat around the hair.
Susan is the heaviest sleeper in cinematic history. Like, not only does she sleep through like the, you know, the necklace sort of beheading part, but then like her feet are fully submerged and like her feet are just like bubbling away and she's just like blissfully asleep. Yeah. Like when people talk about dying in their sleep, that's what they're thinking about. This is how I want to go. I want to go peacefully in my sleep. No pain.
Well, the bed just absorbs
Susan.
Me.
So we now cut back to Sharon's brother. He makes a call from a payphone, gets a little bit of insight into where his little sister might be, and then he hangs up. Shortly thereafter, Diane and Sharon return to the cellar and discover that Susan is nowhere to be seen. When Sharon leaves this is the flower that grows from Susan's recent grave in the ground outside. It is weird. So they pick flowers and Sharon leaves one of these flowers on the bed. The bed begins to bleed internally once more. So it's at this time that Painting Pete takes us through the bed's lengthy and elaborate backstory about, and jump in because I didn't go into like specifics necessarily, but it's about the demon and the dead woman and all the bed related deaths that have occurred since. So it's at this moment that Painting Pete realizes just how similar Sharon looks to the dead woman, the very first dead woman, the woman that the bed considers to be its mom.
Ew.
So that's how this works. So the bed considers the demon to be its dad and this woman to be its mom.
Right.
Because they brought life to this bed that was just a bed.
If I'm honest,
which you will be.
The bed's backstory is of absolutely no interest to me in this film whatsoever.
Yeah, it's like you said, right.
I just don't need to know it. I'm just happy that it's eating people.
Yeah.
I also didn't go into any sort of detail about all the deaths from the priest and the old gay woman.
Oh my gosh, the priest is my favorite death.
And the gangsters and the orgy. So please just like chime in because I established that they die. I didn't like go into how because it's so long.
We get this very, very long montage of all the deaths that have happened in the bed. What's your favorite?
I just love the mobsters. I just love the Jim Jam mobsters playing probably like Go Fish or something.
Yeah. Oh, and when one of them dies, they have a cigar. Yeah. And then and then it's just, he's obviously somehow been eaten. Yeah. And then there's the cigar.
Vertical pointing to the ceiling.
Is being absorbed. Oh, that's amazing.
My favorite part of that as well, despite them just kind of cross-legged on a bed together, despite them being gangsters or whatever, is like one dude's friend is getting eaten by this foam. So he takes his gun and goes, I'm being eaten alive. And he starts shooting the bed.
Just very calmly.
They decide to put in like a shooty sound for like the first two shots. Yeah. As he very gently sort of like points it. But then like the other guy grabs it and does the same thing. No shooty sounds. They were like, oh, we've run the budget on the shooty sounds. Yeah.
Just two shots is all we can get. My favorite one is the priest. He's reading the Bible and it's actually his performance that makes me laugh so much because he is so... So he looks like a student has just like spat their gum at him or something. That's the level of indignation we're getting at him being eaten alive by a bed that he's in.
All right. So long ass backstory out of the way. Diane and Sharon are still searching for Susan. Diane eventually returns to the cellar, lights a fire and starts drinking wine. And I guess she's just done looking now. She fucking hated
Susan's
guts. And
where is she drinking the wine?
On the bed.
On the bed.
Of course, because everyone eats and drinks on the bed in this film.
Yeah. But this bitch hated Susan anyway. So like, good fucking riddance. Who needs her?
Same.
Yeah. Diane takes a seat on the bed and the film's third act begins. Dinner.
Oh, a lovely bit of dinner.
Dinner.
Diane gets comfortable on the bed.
No tea time.
The overeating deathbed where he has like breakfast, brunch, lunch, 11s, like the whole
snack,
the
time.
Whole shebang. Dinner, second dinner, tea.
Midnight snack.
Yeah.
3 a.m. snack. Yeah.
So Diane gets comfortable on the bed. She lies down, she lights a cigarette, she takes a couple drags, and then she falls asleep. Her hand begins to droop, and the still lit cigarette resting between her fingers slowly lowers and lowers and lowers until making contact with the bed.
And then what does Pesky Pete or whatever his name is called?
Pesky Pete. You changed the made up name we've
Stinky
made.
Pete.
Stinky Pete is now in this film. He says something like, I haven't had a cigarette in 70 years.
Yeah.
And it's like...
Yeah, basically, so? Eat in bed, you eat this bitch, I want a cigarette. Go on, have a little go on Diane and give me the cigarettes.
Diane begins to sweat profusely, suffering a similar nightmare to her fallen frenemy, Susan, who funnily enough makes a little guest appearance in her dream. Diane walks over to Susan. She's reading by the fire, reading a book of dead people, and they're both in it. But all the pages are blank. Diane can't see herself in there at all. Susan's just being a bitch again.
Of course she is. Even in death.
Susan's a gaslighter. She is so unlikable.
I hate her. It's like a nightmare where like you encounter your bully in the afterlife and they still suck. They're still mean to you.
But then Susan's like, look in the fire though. So she does, and now the book is on fire. And Diane opens the book again, and now every page is reflective like a mirror.
Oh my gosh, that was so gross.
And she can definitely see herself in this book now. Can't you, Diane?
I don't see her in the book. I saw Susan's face, sort of, but I don't know if that was on purpose.
No, the idea is like she's looking in the mirrored pages.
Yeah.
It's like a cheesy illustration they use at like Christian church camp.
Yeah.
Where it's like, look in this book and it will show you the most precious thing in the world. And it's you. I kind of loved it, I kind of thought that bit was pretty fierce.
Yeah, like the surrealism's fun, the imagery's cool, I like the scene, it's fun. And then before the dream's done, Diane like gratuitously, she's naked. There's no reason.
Oh my God.
For there's literally no point to that. She like, it's like a weird sort of transition where she's like kneeling
I
in her pajamas
that.
Yeah,
and then as she gets up she becomes
naked.
But then when she's fully standing, She's back in her pajamas.
She's not naked anymore.
It's just a weird, like...
We'll just throw it in for you.
It's such a weird choice.
But Diane wakes up from her fever dream. She crawls towards the foot of the bed. When her legs, they fall into the evil bed piss. And she screams in agony and or ecstasy. It's weird.
No one knows how to emote pain in this film whatsoever. Yeah.
When you say screams, you mean she sort of went...
Moans.
Oh.
She moans.
Oh, like the same sound when you like tread in dog shit. Yeah. Like not when your legs are like being burnt by acid. She's just like, oh no. Yeah.
Her top half scrambles desperately to reclaim her bottom half from the pool of yellow liquid.
She that takes quite a long time,
tooth
actually.
Tooth and nail, and then she's free. She tumbles to the ground, her legs limp, and hemorrhaging blood. Exhausted.
Not so much hemorrhaging blood as she's covered in red paint.
So exhausted, Diane slowly drags her body towards the door.
And you mean and slowly.
So this shot takes forever. And
nuts. It's totally nuts.
When I say that this scene is one shot for 3 minutes, it does not depict the lifetime that you experience watching this one shot.
I want you all to stop this podcast right now and just watch the clock for 3 minutes.
Yeah, 3 minutes silence.
Then you will feel.
Here's the thing. It's not a shot that hasn't been used before in horror films.
Right.
But normally when you've got like a... It's like a chase scene. She's like crawling away from a stoic, still bed. Isn't chasing her. Are we supposed to be, is this tense?
Yeah,
are we
there's
supposed
no to be tension scared? Whatsoever.
And then when she reaches the steps, it's just quite awkward. You're just like, oh, come on. Come on.
Yeah, because they don't cut. They don't give us mercy when she gets to the
you
steps.
You watch for what feels like an actual lifetime. So Diane makes it to the front door. She's gripping onto the grass outside. She's made it. But then the bed laughs, and it laughs like a tee-hee. And it fires a bed sheet across the room like this bed is fucking Scorpion from Mortal Kombat.
Oh, I love it.
Okay, and that bit was kind of fierce. Yeah. But this is the introduction of the bed having these, like...
You're so right.
Professor X powers.
There's no tension because you don't know that it can do that yet.
Yeah, and then when it does it, it's kind of cool.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I love it.
It does like this really fast... cool like Spider-Man sling and then just like the slowest, laziest drag back.
God.
It's like, Diane girl, if you escape at this point, I am not sitting through the escape again. No way in hell.
So Diane is in the grasp of one of these bed sheets being dragged backwards when Sharon arrives just in time to do absolutely nothing.
Yeah, let's do Sharon's reaction. That was it.
That was a lot better, actually.
That was her reaction. So unbothered.
This woman can't move her face.
The most nothing reaction. As if Diane is just sat there pleasantly like doing a crossword and sipping on her wine still, not being dragged, covered in blood, dragged by like this bed sheet. Even like as she approaches the bed and Diane has literally now been sucked up from under the bed, which is like, I think our first under the bed death.
Yes,
it is.
Dynamic.
Sharon sees all of this on her hands and knees. Nothing. To be honest, like now I've seen the entire film, the actor that gave the best sort of like fear or any sort of expression is the couple at the beginning.
Yeah.
Like the horny hornbag. At least she's playing up to like a I'm hungry. I'm hungry is the strongest emotion in this film. Whole film.
You believe that she's hungry.
Yes. I'm like fully feeling for this girl. Like, I don't know what the 70s are. Were beds just quite commonly eaten? There's another gone. Oh yeah, this happened to my friend last week.
According to this film, yes.
Yeah.
So Diane's being dragged to her death. Sharon comes in giving no reaction whatsoever. She sort of jogs over towards Diane. Diane is being dragged underneath and then up inside the mattress from under the bed and eats her. And even worse, it slurps up some of her blood that's on the sheets from earlier. The scene finally ends with Painting Pete smoking what must be Diane's cigarette.
And he looks like he's having a great time.
Absolutely.
So the scene ends. It's a new scene and Sharon's brother is driving up and approaching the estate that's not there. Meanwhile, Sharon is sitting just as solemnly as Painting Pete's been sitting throughout the entire film thus far. She's sitting in a far corner of the room, and the hungry bed is just openly fucking with her now. It's laughing at her and is making the door repeatedly swing open and shut. Her brother walks towards the cellar. He opens the door. He sees the blood on the steps that lead inside, and then he sees his sister. He goes, "Sharon!" And same old Sharon. She's not giving a fuck. Like, who gives a fuck if you care for your brother or not? It's like, you might be saved. At least, like, selfishly feel an emotion of like, oh, thank goodness, like, I'm relieved. So Sharon's still maybe processing Diane's strange and extremely recent death, which makes it all the more cruel when the bed decides to spit out one of her dead friend's eyeballs, which is either, it's either one eyeball or five.
Yeah.
That bit was so...
You see it five times. I think it's the same eye every time.
And because I was so convinced at that point we were going to get like this big anthropomorphic bed,
actually turning into
like a bed monster with like the legs being like the big wooden arms.
I would
like
have
this
loved that.
That would have been so, and like with these human eyes and all these like random body parts from the people they'd eaten.
Yeah.
Oh, that would have been great.
Sharon's brother suggests that they at least try to rescue Diane since they can't do much of anything else. Sharon silently agrees as her brother attempts to free her friend by stabbing the bed with an enormous knife. Like, what the fuck are you thinking, Sharon's brother? Like, she's supposedly in there. Like,
oh, yeah.
So he just plunges this long silver blade into the mattress that she's assumedly trapped in. And as you'd expect, it goes terribly. God. Like, I don't know what else to say. It just goes really bad.
Well, his hands get sucked into the vat of yellow acid.
So an important plot point is that his hands and the knife go into this bed. The knife drops, but it falls out of the bottom of the bed, which is the only time we see this happen. And then,
that's interesting.
Yeah.
I didn't notice that.
And then his hands are being dissolved by the piss.
And he can't like take them out for whatever reason.
He can't take them out.
Okay, theory. Painting Pete, who's collecting all these objects, is just collecting them from under the bed. Like, the bed is spitting out the rings, all the other things. And then Painting Pete's just opening his little door where he's allegedly trapped and just scurrying around and getting all these nice things.
It's hopeless. They won't listen.
So yeah, the yucky pee water is dissolving Sharon's brother's hands. And they become these like Frankenstein hand sculptures that like look like hands, but they're made of meat. And he tries and he tries to pull his hands out, and it's no use until it is. And he tumbles backwards and he falls to the ground. He slowly lifts his hands up towards his face, and there's nothing there but bones. He's got some skeleton hands.
He's got two fake skeleton hands.
It's excellent. Yeah, I feel like Sharon's brother gives up too quickly on a life with skelly hands.
Oh, right. Yeah.
Like,
he does not want them at all. He's like, just snap them off for me, Sharon.
Snap them off. Do you know what? Just snap them off, Sharon.
Would he not think they could be useful?
Well, yeah.
In like continuing his life.
Yeah, he already can't bear it. They just got to go. He asks his sister to snap both his fucking hands off at the wrists. After a long pause, Sharon's just down for it. And she needed very little in the way of convincing.
She's not just down for it. She's desperate.
Oh, yeah. She loves it.
Sharon absolutely gets a kick.
This is the most enthusiasm we have seen from this character this entire movie so far. And it appears almost painless for him. It takes a little while. It's kind of gross to listen to, but like, he's not wincing. He's just fine. Yeah. But then once the deed has been done, they decided to throw his bone hands into the fire? Where did that decision come from?
I don't know why they do anything. If I had bony hands that someone had snapped off, you better believe I would keep that shit on a shelf. Yeah. Oh, what are those? Oh, those are my hands. Those are my bony skeleton hands. But they're just like, do you want these? No, just throw them in the fire.
That is where this scene ends, and we begin the film's final course, the just dessert.
Oh,
I hate that they gave it another name that other than just dessert.
Goodness. Yeah, it is.
Just
simply.
Simply. There we go. Simply dessert.
They're just dessert.
Why isn't it the kooky breakfast?
So with 10 minutes left of this film, I'll be honest, it's not looking particularly good for anybody who's not to the bed right now. This day's almost as good as the day it got to eat the entire orgy for breakfast.
If we've got a meal track for this bed, it's had a big breakfast. Mm. It had two people for breakfast.
Yeah.
And then a slightly lighter lunch and dinner, yeah, which I think is the way to go.
Yeah, there you go.
Yeah. Yeah.
So yeah, it's looking pretty good for the bed right now. But then what's that? Why, it's a most opportune and unlikely happenstance, of course. Remember at the very start of the podcast where I mentioned that the demon, the one who made the bed and gave life to the bed, that demon, remember, who only sleeps once every 10 years, and that when he does, Painting Pete only then can communicate with people. Should they happen to be in the room at that exact time that he has this ability to communicate because the demon is asleep for one short nap every 10 years, that happens. And it happens right now.
It also happens four other times, yeah, in the film. This bed can't stop being asleep. It's such a contradiction. I don't understand
the difference between the bed sleeping frequently and lengthily, but it says the demon sleeps only once every 10 years. So this demon who's living in a tree is just constantly awake, still heartbroken that his, like, I don't know, sexual act with that woman didn't work out. He sleeps once every 10 years and boom, he goes to bed right at this moment. And this is perfect because Sharon's in the room and Sharon's about to save the day, everybody.
Sure. Why not?
What's happened with Sharon's brother at this point?
He's still there.
Doesn't she drag him? Drags him outside or something.
Pete instructs Sharon.
Risky Pete, like, sort of.
Risky Pete.
Yep. He gives her a bunch of instructions, instructions.
Pete instructs Sharon on how to do this elaborate, like, seance or ceremonial sacrifice. And it kind of feels like a cop out to me, but basically what happens is, okay, so here it is. Sharon has to drag her brother outside to safety. And I guess the door is unlocked now because the bed's gone to sleep or something. But she drags her brother outside and rolls this poor dude down a hill and he's unconscious. And she, like, props him up on a hill. She has to lay down all these sticks on the floor to create two large circles, although one has to be smaller than the other. She comes back inside. She grabs the knife that very coincidentally fell through the bed the only time this happens. This is the knife she needs. Otherwise, I don't know how this shit's gonna work.
Maybe it's like the bed pooping. Maybe it can't digest things that are dangerous. I don't know. I can't think how it would work.
Actually, I shouldn't play with knives.
I need to drop this. Demon would not like this.
I don't want to carry a knife. Actually, this is too far for me.
She comes back inside. She grabs the knife. She has to carve the same circles into the floor inside the cellar, at which point the floor bleeds and the bed is, like, in pain. It's like wincing. It's going, it's not enjoying it.
Bloody hell.
But the demon's asleep, and I guess this doesn't wake up the demon. It doesn't make a lot of sense. But the big circle is around the bed and the little circle is around Sharon. She has to put her brother's fingers and some of Diane's hair in the middle, I think. Somebody's hair.
To link the circles.
And it links the circles and they disappear and they're joined now.
Nothing from Susan, because fuck Susan.
Yeah, fuck Susan. We don't need Susan.
The Painting Pete is a dirty fucking liar and he made Sharon do this whole ceremony knowing that it was going to kill her.
But it's going to free him,
right? It's going to free him.
What
it's
a
gonna
selfish
free every-
bastard.
It's going to free everybody else in the future. I don't know. It's like that trolley dilemma, isn't it? It's like, does he kill Sharon to spare five?
I mean, to be honest, Sharon is a non-character, so it's not exactly like you're losing anything.
It's like the least dramatic double cross in like film history. Yes. It's like an Ashton Kutcher's punk of like, like she does it and then he's like, haha, got you.
Just kidding.
Sorry, I lied.
But we don't see her die.
We see nothing of Sharon.
We don't hear her die.
She sat on the floor, stoic. We hear a voiceover telling her that she's been double crossed.
Yep.
And then it just cuts to a different scene.
Yeah.
Yeah. So the bed is transported to the large circle outside that she made out of sticks, at which point Sharon, I guess, dies. And in dying, she gives life to the bed's mother, the half-dead girl who fucked the bed's dad.
Yeah.
So she's alive now because there's like a bunch of blood at the foot of her tombstone.
Yes.
And then she appears naked, even though she's been in a coffin for 80 years wearing clothes.
Yes.
Everyone's got to be naked in this film. Everyone except Sharon.
Sharon's the only one.
So the bed's mom is alive. And now we get this like super questionable stuff. Ooh. So she walks over to the unconscious Sharon's brother and Painting Pete says, like, coupled to give life to the bed, coupled to kill the bed. And then I don't know if she just kisses him.
Yeah.
And in doing so, the bed combusts and it's just on fire now.
As anyone else would do if you saw your mum having sex with someone.
Like, mom!
Dear embarrassment.
Mom!
And it's at this point that Painting Pete is like surrounded by smoke and he's like
and heavenly like white light.
Heavenly
it's
white
like
light.
He's on
Stars in their eyes. Tonight, Matthew.
Yes.
And he basically says like something to the effect of, I'm free now. Like, fuck you. You enslaved me, but I'm free now.
But he's taking all his stuff.
I'm going to hell, but I'm taking my rings with me.
Yeah. It's weird. And that's the end of the film. And
thank
that's
God.
The end
that
of the film.
That is the end of the film.
The bed just burns until the credits roll.
Yeah, there's no like after dinner coffee or something.
It's just done.
What a terrible film.
So
here it is. Did anyone enjoy this movie?
Yes.
Would anyone watch this movie again?
No.
Right, I actually don't think I did enjoy it.
Yeah.
Honestly, like,
yeah.
I loved the concept.
Yeah.
But like, I can't even ironically like it, or I can't even fall into this like cult following. I'm just like, that was crap. Right. Total crap.
Right.
There are so many choices that I don't respect, and they don't outweigh the choices that I do, because the surrealism and the lucid, wild dream sort of sequences, those are fun. Those are super fun. The idea for Painting Pete, who's trapped in purgatory, he's kind of fun. But the fact that, like, nobody communicates through actual dialogue.
Yeah, it's the real life parts are the worst bit.
It is so weird. And then the elaborate backstory so that you're supposed to care about the bed. It's like you don't care about the characters. Let's start there.
I think even if they'd have like made all the characters really consciously unlikable, and that Deathbed turned into almost like a bit of an anti-hero character where like you're kind of rooting for the bed because all the humans suck.
Yeah.
Like, even that would have worked a bit better.
Yeah.
But it's just very nothing, sadly.
Yeah.
I hope they had fun filming it. Like, but the problem is I can get on board with things like this when it looks like they had fun filming it. None of them look like they were having a good time. Yeah. I'm just like, it's such a joyless project, it seems like.
Yeah. Thank you for coming.
With all that said, Harry, thank you for joining us on the podcast.
Anytime.
And it's been a lot of fun.
Do you think you'll have Susan's nightmares tonight?
What, eating bugs?
Eating bugs.
Yeah, probably. I mean, genuinely, the whole film did feel like a fever dream. So
yeah,
it was one of those things that in a year's time, I will be thinking like, what's this film? And I'll describe it to someone. But I have no idea what you're talking about.
That film does not exist.
Like, it will, by tomorrow morning, this film will not exist in my
brain.
That
would be the real horror film, as if it turns out by tomorrow that this film never existed. We never did this podcast.
Oh, man. I love that.
Yeah.
Thanks for having me. It was fun.
So that was Deathbed, : The Bed That Eats. We established it after the breakdown of the film. No, nobody can say that they enjoyed the film, but we enjoyed the memories that it gave us
together. Yeah.
And therefore it wasn't a waste of time. I had not seen Deathbed, The Bed That Eats. I'd seen half or more of these films in advance. This one was a real gift.
You would not allow me to look at the screen while you were watching it in order to make your notes before showing it to us. And the only scene that I saw that you promptly covered up was when his hands have turned into skeleton hands. And I just looked at the screen and I said, did I just see what I thought I saw? And then you were like, go away.
Yeah.
Don't look.
But like I said, I've seen half of these films before, and that is true of tomorrow's film, Manos, The Hands of Fate.
Ugh, I hate this film.
You hate it, and we're going to talk about it. And you get more heated than I think you get in any other episode of this podcast, and understandably so. This is a difficult, bad film. And I can't wait, because until this episode, I think Manos was my favorite episode that we'd made for this podcast. So, fuck, it's still going to be a great time.
See you there.